You're listening to the podcast of Village Church in Burbank, California. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org. We hope you enjoy today's message.
Title of my sermon this weekend is A Tale of Two Hearts. And we have before us today another of Jesus' parables from the Gospel of Luke. Luke chapter 18, reading beginning in verse 9. Jesus also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and regarded others with contempt. He said, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, was praying thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all my income. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast and saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his home justified rather than the other. For all who exalt themselves will be humbled, but all who humble themselves will be exalted. Amen. So we have this parable that is compared to some of these others we've dealt with in recent weeks. This one's rather simple. And I have a simple sermon, a shorter sermon for you as well, if you're wondering. We've had a lot of things going on today. Short, simple sermon, but a very meaningful, profound parable here. In this parable, we have two characters, two actors in the play, so to speak. The first one, we're told, is a Pharisee. Who are the Pharisees? The Pharisees were the conservative, religious, political movement that was happening in Israel during this time. They were very devout, very committed, and also very well-liked. They were highly esteemed in first century Jewish culture. Now, the Pharisee movement began long before Jesus' birth, probably about 150 or so years before Jesus was born. We see the Pharisees coming on the scene. And what they emerged from was a conviction. What was happening at this time, among many things, is what historians call Hellenization. And Hellenization was just a fancy word for Greekified. And the whole, like most of the known world, was becoming thoroughly Greekified. You know, just, you know, in terms of culture and ideas, the spread of Greek culture was really beginning to be absorbed in a lot of these other peoples and nations and cultures. Ever since Alexander conquered much of the known world, we see this area becoming gradually Greekified. Hellenized is the proper word. And so this was happening also in the land that we call Israel today. And the Pharisee movement, this was made up of religiously devout Jews who woke up to what was happening and said, wait a minute, if we just absorb without checking this, without question, if we just absorb all of this Greek philosophy and ideas and cultural elements, we're going to eventually lose our distinct sense of identity and calling as the people of God, as the Jewish people. And so we've got to think about this. We've got to renew our sense of Jewish faith, life, and culture ourselves. And so that's really how the Pharisees emerged. It was actually, I think, a God-sent movement at first. It was a needed movement because indeed the people of God, the Jewish people, needed to preserve that sense of identity. And so the Pharisees were actually the right movement at the right time. Sadly, I think eventually as the decades unfolded, they became distorted as a people. And we see that happening in the Gospels when they reject the very one about whom the Bible's trying to point them to. And yet they are the Bible people of their day. We're the Bible readers. We're the Bible-believing people of the day. But when the central subject about whom the Bible's trying to point you to stands in front of their face, by and large, the Pharisees reject him. So that shows you how off track they eventually got. But this Pharisee in this parable, I want you to see him as who he is. He is a religiously devoted man, very committed. On the opposite end of the spectrum is the other character in the story, a tax collector. We're going to talk more about tax collectors next week, but for now, let me just say that the tax collectors were the most compromised people in ancient Jewish society. These were people who had opted out of religious life altogether. They were not attenders of the synagogue. They were actually, by and large, expelled from the synagogue, but even if they were welcome, they typically wouldn't have come anyway. That's not something they're interested in. If they happen to have any ideas about God, they certainly don't allow those ideas to infringe upon the way they live, which is characterized by greed and self-centeredness and cheating other people. So you have two very different people in this parable. And you know, Jesus is a master storyteller. And every great story has an element of surprise. You know, and once you tell a story and it has no element of surprise, it becomes predictable, therefore it becomes boring. And that is my qualm with a lot of the major Hollywood movies that get produced today, is they rely on big budgets and special effects, but they have, to a large extent, they've lost their capacity to tell good stories. And if you want to find good stories, you got to sometimes venture into the world of independent films. That's my film critique for today. And no offense to any of you who works on some of those big budget films. It's not your fault. But anyway, every good story, I'm not trying to start a controversy here. Every good story, though, I think we can agree, has an element of surprise. And the element of surprise in this story is who gets justified. It's how these two people are divided. You know, one of the things about us as human beings is that we do categorize. And I think it's just how we're wired. I don't know that we can help it. We understand things by categorizing them, putting them in different places. And that's what we tend to do with people. We categorize people. And so at first glance, we have in this story two categories of people. We have the religious man and the non-religious man. We have an observant Jew and non-observant Jew. A spiritual person, a secular person, or you might even just simplify it like this. We have a good guy and a bad guy. And the good guy in this story is the Pharisee. I know we're not like used to hearing that because we like to villainize Pharisees. But to the first century audience who received this parable firsthand, the Pharisees unmistakably were the good guys in their culture, and certainly juxtaposed with the tax collectors. The tax collector universally would be thought of as the bad guy in this parable. Now, I've been teaching on this for a few years here. And here's what Jesus sees that a lot of times you and I don't. Jesus divides people not into good people and bad people. He divides the world between the proud and the humble. And that's a revolutionary paradigm shift if you can make it. You know, typically, we constantly, subconsciously, without thinking about it, we tend to divide the world up between the good and the bad, and we put people in those categories. But what I'm suggesting to you this morning is that Jesus doesn't divide the world up like we do. He doesn't divide the world up between good and bad people. He divides the world between the proud and the humble. I want us to work on this for a moment. What do we know about the Pharisee in this story? Well, one thing that we're told here is that he fasts twice a week. So that right there tells you he takes his faith seriously. You know, I mean, no matter what you think about his motives, I don't know what's in his heart. I'm not going to claim to know what's in his heart. But I know anybody who fasts twice a week, I feel safe in saying they take their faith seriously. So he fasts twice a week. He tithes. Gives 10% of his income. He has a regular rhythm of daily prayer. That's what he's doing here in the story. In fact, he's also a tender of synagogue every Sabbath, so he's part of houses of worship. He's in the temple here. So this is a very devout man religiously. He doesn't cheat on his taxes. He doesn't cheat on his wife. What's wrong with any of that? The answer to that is nothing. Nothing's wrong with that. That's actually all good. It's good that you take your faith seriously to the point where you're willing to fast twice a week, which is an act of real self-denial. And you pray like he does, and you attend houses of worship every time the doors open, and you live a morally upright life. Nothing wrong with any of that. So why is he unjustified before God? Why is he not forgiven? Because Jesus makes that explicit here. Whereas the bad guy, the tax collector, is justified and made right. What's going on here? What's the problem? Like his problem is not that he lives a morally upright life. His problem also is not his beliefs. Because theologically, much of what this Pharisee believes is correct. If you were to give a theology quiz to the Pharisee and the tax collector, Pharisee's going to get way more right. So he believes right things. He's practicing a lot of good things. He's morally upright. He's religiously devout. These are all good things. So what is the problem? Why is he not justified? His problem is that he excludes himself from the community of sinners. That's the problem. He excludes himself from the community of sinners. He says, God, thank you that I'm not like these other people. And he zeroes in on particular kinds of people, extortioners, people who are unjust, adulterers, people who have rejected religion, like tax collectors. He says, God, thank you that I'm not like that. And in so doing, he excludes himself from the category of sinners. And thus, he prevents himself, his pride prevents him from belonging to the community of sinners and seeking and finding mercy. Now, that word sinner is a strong word. Like, if somebody called you a sinner, not like joking, but like serious, you're a sinner, that carries a little bit of a punch to it, does it not? Yeah? Now, in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, in these four books that begin our New Testament, the word sinner occurs 30 times, actually a little bit more than I would have expected. 30 times in the four Gospels, we find the word sinner. Here's what's more surprising. 26 out of the 30 times the word sinner appears in the Gospels, it's used in a positive context. Only four times in the Gospels do we find the word sinner in any kind of negative context. 26 out of 30 times the word sinner in the Gospels is used positively. It's things like this. He received sinners. He's the friend of sinners. He's eating with sinners. Jesus says, I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners. So 26 out of 30 times that the word sinners used in the Gospels, it's used in a positive way. The four times that it's not, three of them come right after another in Luke 6. Luke 6 is Luke's version of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. We call it the Sermon on the Plain. But it's working with the same material. And in Luke 6, there's a section where Jesus says, if you only love those, and if you're only good to those, and if you only lend to those who love you back and are good to you back and lend to you back, what's the big deal with that? Even sinners do that. So three out of the four negative times we find the word sinner, it's right there compressed together in Luke 6. But even in that case, it's really more of an ambivalent usage, I would say. And then the other time Jesus uses the word in kind of a negative light, and this definitely is a negative light, is when he's being arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he says, now the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. But who are those people into whose hands the Son of Man was being betrayed? It was the religious leadership. I find that fascinating. So the point is this, and I hope you can hear this humbly here this morning. Jesus almost always uses the word sinner in a context of mercy. Jesus' response towards sinners when they show humility is to be merciful to them. So watch this. To qualify for the mercy of Jesus, you have to be willing to self-identify as a sinner. If your mentality is, oh no, I'm not a sinner, I do not belong to that category, I'm not part of the community of sinners, then Jesus' response is to say, well, I have nothing for you then, because I'm here for sinners. When we self-identify as sinners, we are placing ourselves in the category of the kinds of people Jesus came to save. That is a good spot to amen. And according to Jesus, salvation comes to a person by identifying yourself as a sinner and asking for the mercy of God. Here we have a tax collector. I'm telling you, objectively, this is a morally reprehensible human being. And he pounds his chest and prays this simple one-sentence prayer. It's seven words. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And in that one seven-sentence prayer, he's done two things. He has self-identified as a sinner, and he has asked God for mercy. And Jesus says, that guy goes home justified. He goes home made right and forgiven. Now, of course, I've heard people say throughout my life, and I can hear some of you thinking this right now. I can hear you think. And I've heard people say this. They'll say, well, you know, we were sinners, but then we're saved. And after that, we're no longer sinners anymore. Well, good luck with that. Seriously, like, let me know how that works out for you. Because that is, you are on a fast track of becoming a Pharisee. I'm going to tell you the truth. This is a hard pill for some to swallow, but I'm going to tell you the truth. Is that we are all saint and sinner simultaneously. That's the truth. Now, I love that Paul in his epistles, he loves to refer to other believers as saints. Now, here's how you should use the word saint and sinner. Generally speaking, you should refer to others as saints and to yourself a sinner. Because that's what Paul does. When he opens his letter to the Corinthians, his first letter to the Corinthian church, and can we all agree the Corinthian church was messed up? These people were wild. This church was busted up, man. They were broken, spiritually immature. And yet in his opening sentence, he calls them saints. But about himself, Paul says, I'm the chief of sinners. Not the chief of saints, the chief of sinners. Now, here's sometimes where I have to correct people. The Bible doesn't actually say that Paul was the chief of sinners. The Bible records Paul saying of himself, I'm the chief of sinners. I don't know if you got that, but the Bible doesn't objectively say that Paul actually was the chief of sinners. Somebody might say, well, yeah, Ryan, but he presided over the martyrdom of Stephen. That's when I play the Adolf Hitler card. The Bible doesn't objectively say Paul was the chief of sinners. It just records Paul saying of himself, I am the chief of sinners. And why does Paul say that? It's because his sin is the only sin that he knows personally and subjectively. Everybody else's sin he knows objectively, but Paul knows his own sin experientially, and he feels the weight and the guilt of it. I'm going to read to you this poem that I recently came across, written by Walt Whitman, one of America's great poets. And normally I don't like to read from the pulpit because people have a tendency to drift off, but I'm going to risk it, so I'm asking a favor of you. But this is a very simple, short poem. It's a really powerful poem, and I wanted to share it with you. It's entitled, You Felons on Trial in Courts. And it's found in Leaves of Grass. Here it goes. You felons on trial in courts, you convicts in prison cells, you sentenced assassins chained and handcuffed with iron, who am I too that I am not on trial or in prison? Me, ruthless and devilish as any, that my wrists are not chained with iron or my ankles with iron. You prostitutes flaunting over the trottoirs, which means sidewalks, or obscene in your rooms. Who am I that I should call you more obscene than myself? Oh, culpable, I acknowledge, I expose. Oh, admirers, praise not me, compliment not me, you make me wince. I see what you do not, I know what you do not. Inside these breastbones, I lie smutched and choked. Beneath this face that appears so impassive, hell's tides continually run. Lusts and wickedness are acceptable to me. I walk with delinquents with passionate love. I feel I am one of them. I belong to those convicts and prostitutes myself, and henceforth I will not deny them, for how can I deny myself? I don't know what you think about that poem. I think Walt Whitman has said something very wise there. When he says, you know, when I think about those people in our society who are deemed guilty and convicted, assassins and prostitutes, I dare not exclude myself from that community, from that category, because I know my own guilt. I know my own sins, my own crimes. I too stand guilty and convicted. I've at least assassinated people's character with my words. I may not have prostituted my body, but I've prostituted my soul by embracing principles that are less than noble. I think he's very smart to say this, to take that mentality. And right in the middle of his poem, he includes this enigmatic phrase. He says, I expose. Now, expose is a noun. You know, it's, we all know what expose means. It's like that investigative report about some scandal that's happened, like 60 Minutes or Frontline or something like that. Or I'm sure we have our local version of investigative journalists who are going to get to the bottom of it. So expose is a noun, but Walt Whitman, because he's a poet and he can do stuff like this, he just transforms that noun, expose, into a verb. And he says, I expose. What he's doing is he's telling on himself. And he's saying pretty transparently here, he's saying, all you people, you admire me and you talk about what a great poet I am and what a wonderful person I am and you compliment me, but it makes me wince because I know the thoughts that run through my head. I know what's in my heart, what's underneath these breastbones. I know the kind of man I truly am. You don't see it, but I do. And in the middle of the poem, he just says, oh, culpable, I don't deny it, I acknowledge, I expose, which is a way of saying, I confess, but I like that he says, I expose, because it doesn't sound all religious and contrived. It's more poetic, it's more powerful. So he's saying, I'm not going to do an expose. He's not interested in doing an expose on convicts and assassins and prostitutes. Instead, he's going to do an exposition on himself, because he knows that he's guilty himself. Well, the Pharisee in this parable, he's just as happy as can be to do an exposition on adulterers and extortioners and tax collectors. And he has enough trust in himself that he can, first of all, he has the right and he also has the capability of looking into everyone else's lives and identifying their sin, which anybody can do. It doesn't take some keen spiritual insight to identify somebody's sin. Jesus says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they'll see God. You know you have a purity of heart when you can look at people and you can see God at work in their lives. That's a sign of maturity, not sin inspection. That, you don't have to be a genius to do that. But our tax collector here, he's not interested in doing an exposition on anybody else's sin but his own. And he pounds his chest in sorrow. He says, God, be merciful to me, a what? A sinner. That's him saying, I expose. I'm a sinner. I'm not pointing my finger at others. I'm a sinner. I expose. In other words, the tax collector does not exclude himself from the community of sinners. And when he says, I expose, and he asks for mercy, what happens? Oh, he goes home justified. He's made right. He's healed. He's forgiven. One more point, and then we'll close. But I have to give you one more point that I have been feeling the weight of all week. Here in our modern, hyper-individualistic age and culture, and especially this city, we're hyper-individualistic. What we do sometimes is we take this matter of confessing sin and we make it a private, personal matter between the lone individual and God. No one else is involved. Nobody's there to hear or to receive our confession or pronounce forgiveness. It's just me and God. I make my private confession of sin. That's how we operate by default in our society. It's fine, I suppose. Theologically, it's fine. But years of pastoral experience tell me that that's not nearly enough to receive the kind of healing that we need. We need to be able to self-expose within a community of trust. Or else we may be forgiven, but the healing doesn't go nearly as deep. As Johnny Cash once sang, flesh and blood need flesh and blood. And I'm a Johnny Cash guy. I'm going to quote Johnny Cash every few months because it's good for your soul. Flesh and blood need flesh and blood. Now, theologically, do I believe that a person can privately confess their sin before God and repent and find forgiveness. Totally. I absolutely believe that. So fear not. I know all the verses, 1 John 1:9, etc. But remember, I'm not just a Bible reader, I'm a pastor, and my years of experience tell me flesh and blood needs flesh and blood. And if you want full healing, it's not enough just in the privacy of your own personal relationship with God to approach God for mercy. See, the problem with personal problems is that they remain personal. And why do they remain personal? Because we lack the community of trust so that it becomes a shared problem. I'm not talking about the whole church, but I'm talking about one or two people within your community. That's what is the secret, by the way, Mike Watts. This is the secret behind the success of recovery programs. The secret largely is in the fact that now my personal problem can become a shared problem. And in that kind of context of sharing that problem, that's what goes a long way towards our healing and freedom. Now, we're not talking about exhibitionism. Everybody here needs to know everything about my business. That's not what we're talking. We're not talking about exhibition. We're talking about honesty, even with one or two. And we're not talking about celebrating sin. We're talking about a culture where sinners are welcomed home as they are. So there's a big difference between those things, and I don't want you to hear me wrongly. It's not exhibitionism. It's honesty. It's not celebrating sin. It's a culture where sinners are welcomed home as they are, because it's in that kind of loving embrace, the kind of embrace that the prodigal son received. That's what leads. That's the first step. That's the beginning of one's transformation. All right, so let's be a welcome home culture at Village. I'm not saying we're not that. I'm not saying we are that. I'm saying that's what we constantly have to work on, is being a welcome home culture, because too often churches become like a police state of informants rather than what Bob Dylan calls a shelter from the storm. I'll quote Bob Dylan too, you know, if I have to. Churches can become a culture of pretense and performance and competition and comparison. All of that's unhealthy, and that's what the Pharisee is embodying for us here in this story. But church needs to be a place where the Jesus story can intersect with my story, with your story, with your story, with all of our stories. And that happens, first of all, when people can tell their stories as they are, where they don't have to pretty it up. But in order for that to also happen, so we can connect with the Jesus story and find the salvation and the healing we need, the church has to be the kind of place where people feel safe sharing their story. But if a church is just a place where people come to look good instead of being the one safe place where we can risk looking bad, then we lose that storytelling forum and the salvation and the redemption and the communion that it provides. So speaking of our church, speaking of this community, are we a city of refuge or are we a police state? Are we confessors receiving the confession of one another and pronouncing forgiveness? Because there are some people that desperately need those environments. Or are we informants who just can't wait to tell somebody what I just heard? May we be a church where people can tell their stories, find forgiveness, and a new start. May we be a shelter from the storm.
Thank you for listening to today's message. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org.